Thank you so much for the opportunity to study God's Word with you. Thank you for loving God's Word, loving one another. Certainly appreciate it. If you will, open your Bibles to Acts chapter 23. We'll be spending our time in Acts chapter 23. Let's talk for just a moment about Paul on trial. You know, I noticed that Paul is going to be tried by the Jews like he is in this chapter. And when he eventually is judged by the Romans, he appears before seven Roman officials. And not one of them can find any fault in him. Isn't that amazing? Paul was a great man of integrity. He obeyed the gospel. He lived an exemplary life. And if anyone could have found fault with him, it would have been the Romans, but they couldn't find anything. In fact, they agreed more than once. If he had not appealed to Caesar, but he had to appeal to Caesar to save his life because the Jews wanted to kill him, and we'll see that again tonight in this chapter, they admitted if he had not appealed to Caesar, he would have been set free. So let's go ahead and talk for just a moment about this council. In verse 1, we see, "And Paul, earnestly beholding the council, said, Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." Now let's talk a moment about the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin council was the supreme court of the land for the Jews. Now they had to report to the Romans because the Romans controlled the territory. But notice that they had 70 members, and about 40 of them were Sadducees. There were about 20 more that were Pharisees, and the rest were not affiliated with any religious group. I'm afraid sometimes we think that all of them would have been either Pharisees or Sadducees or Essenes or Zealots or one political party or religious party. Most people were not a member of any party. But the ones who were on the Supreme Court of the land, the Sanhedrin Council, referred to here in verse 1 as the council, they were very, very powerful. And remember that they're the ones that condemned Jesus to death. They condemned Stephen to death, but I don't know how much time has passed. If I had to estimate since Stephen was stoned to death, probably between 17 and 20 years had passed. And more than likely, Paul, because he had been in Gentile territories on missionary journeys, probably didn't know who the high priest was. That wasn't necessarily his forte any longer. But we notice in verse 2, because Paul said, "I have lived in all good conscience before God unto this day." Now, Christians would be shocked at that, because how could he have a good conscience and persecute Christians, yet he thought he was doing God a favor? And Jews would have a hard time believing that because he was preaching to Gentiles. So notice there in verse 2, "Then the high priest Ananias commanded that them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth." Now you think about that. You're just standing there and you say something and somebody in a court of law strikes you on the mouth. You know, as we talked about last night, that's illegal. He was a Roman citizen. They shouldn't have even hit him. But Ananias was the high priest. By the way, the high priest changed from year to year. And before the Romans started selling the office, it was passed down from father to son. And if a man did not have a son, and let's say he had a daughter, then the man's son-in-law was qualified to be the high priest. If he didn't have children, but he had nephews, then the nephew would be qualified to be the high priest. It was the next of kin. And so it was an inherited office from year to year. Now, notice how Paul responds when he is hit on the mouth. "Then Paul said unto thee, God shall smite thee, thou whitened wall. For sittest thou to judge me after the law and commandest me to be meant contrary to the law? He's a whitewashed wall. Now, what in the world is a whitewashed wall? Well, I think we all know. What if you bought a house and you found out they had a bad foundation, but somebody had taken a cement or putty or something and filled in the cracks and painted over it and you couldn't tell it? Well, that would be a whitewashed wall. I think the idea comes from Ezekiel, where we see false prophets referred to as whitewashed walls. Talking about walls that are crumbling, the paint hides the cracks. He's insinuating the high priest is a hypocrite, but notice those around him rebuke him. Revilest thou God's high priest? In other words, do you dare say anything against the high priest? Do you not know who he is? Now, I want you to notice something there in verse 5. Paul is sorry for what he said. He said it in retaliation. He said, I wist, and the word wist means I know. I did not know, and I wist not, brethren, that he was the high priest. For it is written, thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people. That comes from Exodus chapter 22 and verse 28. Thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people. I'm satisfied that a lot of news media and a lot of late night talk show hosts obviously do not abide by that. Thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people. But Paul is very shrewd. He's very wise. Now, he's very aware of the Sanhedrin. I don't know that he ever served on the Sanhedrin. Not being a married man, I'm not sure he would have ever been qualified, according to the Jewish law, to have served on the Sanhedrin. But he was climbing the ladder of Judaism. And so, notice what happens. Paul notices that part of the group are Sadducees and the other are Pharisees. Now, we know the difference, and Luke is about to tell us a little bit about the difference there. But Paul was a Pharisee. Pharisees believed in many things. They believe in the resurrection of the dead. They believe in angels. They believe in spirits. They believe in an afterlife. The Sadducees did not believe in any of that. I've often wondered, what did the Sadducees have to look forward to? They didn't believe in an afterlife, and so I suppose it was just live it up in this life because there's nothing coming afterward. But when Paul realizes this, notice what he says in verse 6. He cried out in the council, men and brethren, I'm a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, of the hope and the resurrection of the dead, I am called into question. Paul was very wise, because as soon as he said that, a dissension arose between them, and the Sadducees became angry, because before the Sanhedrin council, which they controlled, he had just endorsed the idea of the resurrection of the dead, which they didn't believe. By the way, the Sadducees controlled the temple. And the Pharisees controlled the synagogue. You remember when the children of Israel were carried away into captivity into Babylon, they couldn't get back to the temple to worship. And so they established assembly, and the word for assembly is synagogue. And synagogue was where they would meet for worship. Synagogues were places where it's bleacher seating. And so around the walls there would be bleacher seating, and the chief priest and the high officials sat on the bottom bleacher. They'd have courtside seats. The higher up you went on the bleachers, the less important you were. And you remember when James talks about telling the poor man, sit here on my footstool, that would be where you'd put your feet on the bleachers. But to the rich man, they'd say, you know, take this seat. In other words, ringside seat on the very, very bottom. Now, when they came back from Babylonian captivity after 70 years, They brought the synagogue with them. And in fact, in Jerusalem, there were about 120 synagogues in ancient times when they came back. Every group pretty much had their own synagogue. And so synagogues, to have a synagogue, you had to have at least 10 men to have a synagogue. When Karen and I lived in Jasper and worked with the Sixth Avenue congregation, there was a Jewish synagogue, they called it a temple, across the road from the church building on Sixth Avenue on Fifth Avenue. Beautiful, ornate building. You've probably seen it. While we were there about 20 years ago, the number of men dropped below 10. And they had to close up in Jasper and move their group to Birmingham and start worshiping there because the number dropped too low to still have a synagogue. And so that's been the rule. If you'll remember, when Paul went to Philippi, he always would go to the synagogue first, but there was no synagogue. And so he went out to the riverside, he and his companions, and that's where they met Lydia and the women who were out there praying and taught them the gospel, ended up baptizing them into Christ. So that's a little bit of background about the Pharisees. So the Sadducees are really upset because Paul has endorsed the idea of the resurrection. And now the crowd becomes divided. Because remember, the Sadducees, look at verse 8. For the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. And so Paul knew what he was doing. He was on trial, but he diverted the attention to those in the room, the court, the 70 members. So look at verse 9. And there arose a great cry, and the scribes that were of the Pharisees part arose and strove, saying, we find no evil in this man. But if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God. Now, you see what they were doing? They were promoting their cause. What if an angel spoke to him? What if a spirit spoke? See, the Sadducees didn't believe it. They didn't believe either one. And so a disruption has occurred. And you remember Claudius Lysias, the chief captain? He's standing there and he's afraid they're going to rip Paul apart. And Paul is a Roman soldier. So let's just notice who all's in this. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Roman soldiers, and Paul. You have four groups there. And the only one trying to keep the peace was the Roman soldier. And so he jumps in because he's concerned that Paul will be pulled to pieces, according to verse 10. But the key verse in this section of Acts 23, for me, I'm not trying to tell you what to believe on that, but to me, verse 11 is the key verse. That night, the night following, the Lord stood by him, saying, be of good cheer, Paul, for as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou also bear witness also at Rome. Paul wanted to go to Rome. Now, why is this so significant? The Lord just promised Paul that he's going to be spared. Now we know why Paul wasn't concerned when they were on a ship going to Rome, when they wrecked and spent the winter at Malta. Now we understand why he was not terrified. The Lord made a promise. And we all know the Lord keeps his promises. And so notice that the Lord's comfort here. So in addition to the comfort that Paul received from the Jews, remember a few moments ago as I reminded you that Jews were trying to kill him, the Jewish leaders. That's not saying all Jews, but the Jewish leaders trying to kill him. So more than 40 Jews make a plot to kill Paul. And then notice this, they take an oath that they will not eat or drink until Paul has been killed. Let's say a word about oaths. It's dangerous to take an oath and promise God that you'll do something, because you can never break it. So be really careful. I'm not talking about taking an oath of office if you're going to serve, or an oath if you're going to serve on a jury. This is an oath that you make between you and the Lord. I won't go into it, but a lot of people have come to me and they made a promise to God, an oath to God, and now they haven't been able to keep it. And it's bothering their conscience. So be careful about making an oath to God. But these 40 men made an oath to God that they would not eat or drink until Paul was dead. And Paul's going to live several more years. So those fellows must have really gotten hungry and thirsty because they'd made this plot to kill him. Let's notice here what happens next. The oath is shared with the chief priests and the elders. There's some politics going on here. And what they want to do, these 40 men, they want the chief priests and elders to make a request of the chief captain, Claudius Lysias, and say, bring Paul here. And we're going to ambush him on the way and kill him. Now, does that sound like religious people? Does that sound like God-fearing people? Not at all. They're going to kill somebody. And now notice something. Look at verse 16, if you will, of Acts chapter 23. When Paul's sister's son heard they're lying in wait, he went and entered into the castle and told Paul. He visited Paul in jail, basically. Now, let me ask you something. You think that was just a coincidence? I don't know, but it's a great coincidence. I don't know how you feel about the providence of God. I had a good friend. His name was Jim. He was a former Secret Service agent for the United States government, and his son graduated in July of that year. I think it was 1988. He graduated in May, and in July, he was driving, and he dropped something in the floorboard and veered over in front of a dump truck, and it killed him. And so every time I'd tell Jim, I believe in the providence of God, he'd say, do you think God killed Daniel? You think God killed that? Did he plan that? I don't think so. I think it's time we give credit to whom credit's due. Let's blame the devil for sickness and death. Let's stop blaming God for every bad thing that happens. And so what we understand here, I believe providence is God working secretly in our lives. And I can't tell that until I look back in the past, and I believe I can see where God made decisions for us and guided us in the way. I'm not talking about a miracle. I think the age of miracles has ceased. But when I look back in my past, I didn't know what decisions to make. And I made some poor decisions sometimes. But I believe, looking back, there were times when God intervened and stepped into my life. Now, I'm not asking you to believe that. If you don't believe that, that's fine. We're still in fellowship. But I believe God impacts our lives and has a part to do with our lives. And so I believe it was by providence that his sister's son, his nephew, heard this information. So Paul calls for one of the centurions and asks him to take his nephew to the chief captain because he has something to say. And the centurion brought him, the chief captain, and asked his nephew what he had to say. And so the nephew begins. Let's look at verses 20 and 21. He said, the Jews have agreed to desire thee, that thou wouldest bring down Paul tomorrow into the council, as though they would inquire somewhat of him more perfectly. But do not thou yield unto them, for there lie in wait with them more than 40 men, which have bound themselves with an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him, and now they are ready, looking for a promise from thee. These were religious people, but they were going about doing some terrible, terrible things and intended to kill Paul, and the nephew heard about it, and now he's done his job. He's told it. Look, if we know something is going on that's wrong, and we can stop it, our tendency is not to get involved, but we need to get involved. You know, a whole lot of people are mandatory reporters. Preachers, school teachers, court officials, lawyers. What mandatory reporter means, if you know a child is being abused, for example, or you know someone is planning to hurt somebody, murder somebody, you don't have a choice. If you don't tell it, then you can be in trouble yourself. If we know of someone being abused, we have an obligation to do the right thing. That's what Paul's nephew is doing. And so notice what happens. I admire what the chief captain does here. He dismisses Paul's nephew, tells him not to inform anyone of the plot. And what does he do? He tells the centurions to get ready. And I just wanted to list here who was going to escort Paul that night out of that area, out of Jerusalem. 200 soldiers. 70 horsemen, 200 spearmen, and provide mounts for Paul to ride. Correct me, Brother Byron. This is the only time I remember Paul riding on an animal, on a horse. I could be wrong. But they need to make haste because Claudius Lysias is trying to protect a Roman citizen, like we talked about last night, and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. And he tells them that the men will be traveling, leaving for Caesarea. Our time would be 9 p.m. Reckon why they left at night. I've always wondered if they would make sure that they went under the cover of darkness so that they would not be spotted by these 40 men trying to kill him. And so they escort Paul by night to Antipatris. That's about 35 miles from Jerusalem. And so this large group of people, I forgat to count, was that about 470 people escorting this one man. Does that tell you how important a Roman citizen was? And so they escorted him through the night. And notice the soldiers then returned to Jerusalem, but the horsemen continued with Paul to Caesarea. Now let's talk for just a moment about Caesarea. I wish I had put a map on the screen, but I didn't. I'm sorry. Let's talk about Caesarea. Paul's going to live at Caesarea in prison for two more years. He's going to live in Rome in the prison for 2 years in a rented house, but he's going to stay in Caesarea for 2 years. And so Caesarea, let's talk about it for just a moment. It's called, technically it's called Caesarea by the Sea. But some people call it Caesarea Maritima. Herod, we talked about Herod the Great, which I was thinking on the way down here tonight from Tennessee, I think we should have called him Herod the Stinky because that's what he was. But he had palaces everywhere, and he had a palace at Caesarea. He also had a harbor at Caesarea. You can still see the ruins of that harbor. He had a hippodrome. You know, a hippodrome, I didn't even know this when I was a kid, but Nashville, when we lived there, they had a hippodrome, Oldsmobile, and I asked, what in the world is a hippodrome? It's a horse racing track. And so Herod had a horse racing track at Caesarea. It was kind of a special place. And by the way, if you go to Caesarea today, a friend of mine returned from there 2 weeks ago on an archaeological dig, and there's a 3,000-seat arena there. And the acoustics are so good that if you're sitting anywhere there and somebody's on the stage, you can hear what they're saying. Now, the stage had rotted away, but in modern times, they've rebuilt the stage. And somebody can sit on there, and there are walls behind the stage, and it projects the sound. And just imagine, it's been there for over 2,000 years, but they still have concerts. They still have things going there at Caesarea. So Caesarea was a place where Paul was going to be delivered. Now notice in verse, We see the letter that Claudius Lysias sent to Felix. And basically, he tells Felix that this thing, that Paul is being accused of things he's not guilty of. And then notice verse 34, Felix reads the letter from the province he was, and when he understood he was of Cilicia, he said, "I will hear thee," said he, "when thine accusers are also come," and he commanded him to be kept in Herod's judgment hall. Herod had a palace there, and it included a jail, and so let's keep him there in the praetorium. Now, I want you to notice something about old Felix. Let's go back. We're almost finished. Please be patient with me as we finish up tonight. I want you to notice something about old Felix. Let's talk a little bit about him. That sounds more like a cat to us than it does a person probably, but I think I knew somebody named Felix, a man. But let's talk a little bit about Felix. Why do we even know about Felix? Well, Felix was the governor. But how did he become a governor? He married King Herod Agrippa's daughter, youngest daughter, Drusilla. And Drusilla was 14 years old when her first marriage. You know, remember last night I said Jewish women could not file for divorce, but Roman women could. So she divorced her husband, and Felix left his wife and married her. And because her daddy was the king, he was appointed the governor. You think there's nepotism and some political things going on there? I believe so. And so now Felix and Drusilla are so powerful. And the Lord willing, tomorrow night we're going to talk more about Felix and Drusilla. Because Felix, I believe, when Paul preached the gospel to him, and he would to Agrippa, he would to his father-in-law later, I think Felix almost obeyed the gospel. So let's talk a little bit about some lessons we can learn from this tonight. Well, first of all, I think what we learn is that we're going to face opposition. All who live godly shall suffer persecution. The devil is always going to make sure that we get in trouble for doing the right thing. If you stand for what's right, you're going to have people oppose you. I don't know how you felt about liquor by the drink election that was going on a few years ago in Hamilton. But Todd Clifford and I opposed it strongly, and we would be on television and call-in show and people call in. And it got so rough, and I'm not exaggerating. It got so rough that the Hamilton Police Department had to come over and escort us home because of threats on our lives. Todd called me while the police were escorting, and he said, "I have more firepower in my truck than those police have in their car." And I said, "Well, I don't have anything." So I'm just thankful that they're here. Why am I telling you that? Not to get sympathy, you know. We won by 52 votes, but then the next time, 2 years later, we lost by over 400. Somebody changed their minds. Why am I saying that? Whatever you stand for, and we think we were standing for right, you're going to have opposition. And Paul had opposition. And in fact, he's going to be martyred. He's going to be put to death eventually. In AD 67, Paul lost his life, and the same year, Peter lost his life. And Peter was crucified. Tradition says he and his wife were crucified upside down. When he found out he was going to have to be crucified, he said, "Well, the Lord was crucified, and I'm not worthy to be crucified the same way, so crucify me upside down." And that's what they did, according to tradition. Both in AD 67. Think about the big blow that was to the church when they lost Paul and Peter the same year. But the Lord's church still flourished and went on. So, number one, remember we're always going to face opposition. I think when we find out that we have been reviled and we've been rebuked by someone in authority, just like Paul did, he apologized. He made it right. He wanted to be a good citizen. He wanted to do the right things. We also need to be very wise. And if we see a group of people and we know that they have differences, then tactfully, with integrity, use those. Use those for the furtherance of the gospel. Number four, I think we need to rely upon the providence of God. As I said, if I come to a fork in the road, it's not always evident which road to take. But when I look back in retrospect, I can see that the Lord blessed me. I really do. And so trust in the Lord. Trust in His providence. Trust in His care. I don't believe the Lord will let us down. And you know what? Our way of escape might be different than the Lord's. Remember, He will not allow more temptation to come upon us than we can bear. We'll offer a way of escape. I don't know what that way of escape is. When I was a younger person, I thought that had to mean physical life. But I've come to the conclusion that there are a lot of things worse than death. And so sometimes the way of escape is just like Paul, being martyred for the faith. You remember he said, I'm in a strait betwixt the two. He had a desire to depart and be with the Lord. Nevertheless, it was better for them if Paul remained. But Paul was ready to go. And I think that's another lesson for us. We have to be ready to go. And sometimes, finally, before we offer the Lord's invitation and conclude, I think sometimes we just have to realize things are beyond our control. I don't think Paul wanted to be in prison for 2 years. And it was he was kept in prison for 2 years as a favor to the Jews. As a favor, a political favor to the Jews, he was left in prison for 2 years. Sometimes things are just beyond our control. And so what Paul had to do is he had to learn to be content in whatever state he found himself in. If he was free, if he was in prison, whatever, wherever Paul was. Tonight we offer the Lord's invitation. Perhaps there's someone tonight that needs to be baptized into Christ. If you do, we'll be glad to help you. Brother Byron will be ready to assist you in doing that. Do you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? Of course you do. And are you willing to take actions on that? You can do so this very night. And not only will the angels of heaven rejoice, we'll rejoice right here at White House tonight. If you have obeyed the gospel, but you've strayed from your commitment to the Lord, and you've been examining your spiritual life, and you know that you're lacking, don't be embarrassed. We love you. We want to do what's right. We can pray with you and for you. Confess your faults one to another, pray one for another. We want to pray with you and for you. It doesn't mean that we're perfect, but the Lord is perfect, and He died that our sins can be taken away. If you need to respond to the gospel invitation, please do so as together we stand and sing.